Hello, everybody. You're about to listen to my interview with the amazing Oliver Rhodes of Alto Projects. This episode is going to be a little bit different to the usual in that we're going to be talking more generally about the industry at large, how we both came to be in the consulting game, our background together, working together over the last quite a few years, and some of the learnings that Oliver has come across as he has struck out on his own, built his own independent consultancy. We do similar things in the way that we provide tech consulting and operational consulting and process consulting. And this is a fantastic conversation. It will be fantastic episode number 200. And this follows Oliver when he was on the podcast for episode 100. So hopefully you enjoy this conversation. Hopefully it's really enlightening. Hopefully it gives you some insights in the industry that we have never covered before on the podcast. Enjoy. This is the E-Commerce Edge podcast with your host, Jason Greenwood. Mate, this is so cool. This is going to be a little bit of a different, for those of us listening maybe for the first time to the podcast, or maybe you've listened to lots of the podcasts till now. This is going to take a little bit of a different course to the typical podcast with the E-Commerce Edge. Typically, we have a platform specialist, or we have doing a mentor session, or we're talking to a specialist in their field, and we would normally dig deep on technology and tech and integration and functionality and UX and business building and e-commerce and omnichannel. We would be digging deep. But today, we want to take a slightly different course with my very good friend, Oliver Rhodes. He is one of the very few people that has now appeared on the podcast. And he also has the dubious distinction as of this episode of being lucky episode 200, just like he was lucky episode 100. So welcome back to the pod, Oliver. Ollie.
Thank you very much. It's like we planned it this way. But it's still there was still 100 episodes in between.
We didn't even talk about this at episode 100.
It's not the fastest return. I know I've been in high demand.
You have. I'm lucky that I was able to get some of your valuable time. And quite a few things have changed in your life since our last conversation. Quite a few things have changed in my life since our last conversation. I think I was still at Mustache Republic as of episode 100 and was doing this just a little bit as a sideline. I'm now doing this pretty full on, pretty dedicated to the cause, as I'd like to say. And now running my own consultancy. And you're now running your own consultancy. The last time you were on, we were talking about Supply Compass, the PLM company that you were heading up basically sales and marketing for and content for. Your life's changed quite dramatically. They imploded. They went out of business. You've now gone out on your own. You're doing some similar work. Like, we have overlap in some of the things that we do, but you do things in a very different way to me. And based on your experience, based on your background, based on your whole category creation process, based on your product development process that you had learned when you were at PeopleVox. And there's been lots of changes in our lives in the intervening 100 episodes, hasn't there?
Yeah, it's been quite a big couple of years for me. I moved out into the countryside post COVID in London, and then got stuck down in Devon. There's worse places to be stuck in the UK. Devon's beautiful, but yeah, I was working out of the attic there for nearly 2 years. That temporary 6 month move in with the in-laws on a remote farm in Devon turned into nearly 2 years. Had a baby in between, second child, so now I've got a 5-year-old and an 18-month-old. And I'm finally where I saw myself being in, this is the glory of work, remote work, being in my own office, in my own house, under my own roof, which is quite nice to be back here and yeah, running my own business as well, which has been 12 months at the end of this month, pretty much. Since I had a big flip.
I'm so happy for you. And I think I was maybe pushing you as hard into doing your own thing for a while there as you were. And I knew that this was where you ultimately needed to end up. And I knew that after Supply Compass, you were looking at other opportunities, other software platforms, SaaS platforms that you could maybe go and take a lead on sales, marketing, all things go to market for them. And that's your background and what you're really skilled at. But I always knew that you had more to offer than just offering one company your services. I knew that from the first time we met each other all those years ago when I was at HealthPost and you were at PeopleVox. I knew that you would probably end up doing your own thing, and I'm doing my own thing. I also had a big move. I'm now in Mexico, not in New Zealand in my tiny house anymore. So we both had a tremendous amount of change, but I am so stoked to see you bringing your brand of Ollie Rhodes to market, your unique flavor, your unique deep research on products, platforms, technologies, processes, org design, all that stuff that you're bringing to businesses. And what I want to talk about a little bit first, I think today, is the revelation that we talked about before off air around SaaS versus bespoke software. And the fact that you and I are both pretty hardcore SaaS advocates. You know, I don't advocate or work with any on-prem technology at all anymore. Haven't done for years because I see the benefits of SaaS, as do you. But where I think you have made a really unique discovery that can be massively beneficial to the audience is the fact that SaaS, out-of-the-box SaaS, doesn't necessarily work in all situations, in all use cases, for all businesses, for all functions. That's the realization that I think you came to, where you want to help brands in certain cases build bespoke software on top of SaaS platforms, and something that is very specific to their use case that they pay to be built once, and then they effectively own that product as a product. They own that platform for their specific use case. And sure, they may have to pay a year's worth of SaaS fees up front to get that piece of software developed, but then they own it forever and it can be enhanced and extended over time. And that is a revelation that I think maybe even surprised you.
I'm still trying to adjust my brain to how commercially different the offering that we've got is compared to buying a SaaS solution. It's like, when I got into software, it was on-premise. The first PeopleVox WMS was on-premise. And we took it into the cloud and we started selling it monthly, and we had to convince people that you should do it monthly. And it's all about the speed to market of it, adopting the best practices. And I've done that for 12 years. And then I did it at Supply Compass as well, doing off the shelf SaaS product. And I'm massive advocate for SaaS. But if you've got on the way I think about it is on one end of the spectrum, we've got completely bespoke full stack development, like the equivalent of building your own tool, completely custom bespoke. So I'm going to change that. So there's, I actually see it three gears up. So on one end, you've got, just on the commercial piece. So the commercial piece on SaaS, this is the bit that I tweaked on today, is that if you're not doing SaaS, if you are building a bespoke tool, it really is a mind shift for the person buying it. So I was dealing with an experienced CTO today, and they wanted us to do some scoping and work out like some customization, some features around the core product. And they said, oh, I see this as a cost of procurement. And I was like, it's not a cost of procurement at all, because I'm not a VC-backed SaaS company or even a bootstrap one. I'm not working on a 3 to 5 to 7 times multiple. I'm not here to throw cash at salespeople and scaling up. I'm doing a high service bespoke product, which I'm sure I would find a lot of comrades in the old on-premise Access database world. Now, if I went back, I'd probably just miss them. Like, they're at the tail end of their careers. I'd probably sit down with them now and learn loads about, if you're going to do bespoke shit, this is the stuff you need to think about, because it's a completely different way of taking product to market. But the thing that I'm trying to merge, so the thing I'm seeing as my blend, is that, and when we're talking about bespoke, I think it's worth just being clear, the bespoke that we're talking about is using low-code tools. And I'll give you my way of thinking about low code. That is the spectrum. So the way I think about low code is, on one end of the spectrum, we've got SaaS products, and even SaaS product, we could call Google Sheets a SaaS product if we liked. Yeah, we can. This is a SaaS product over here. And at the other end, we've got a full stack platform that we completely build from the ground up, servers, everything, front end, whatever. And then you've got everything along this spectrum. And somewhere a few steps away from full stack is a platform like Retool, which is a phenomenal platform for building internal tools. And I've been speaking with a guy who scaled a D2C business, just using Retool for hacking their marketing to bits, doing some absolutely crazy stuff with data and firing email marketing out of Mailgun, super dirt cheap, high levels of personalization, but just coming at that marketing and growth from a developer's mindset. And then as you move along that scale, back towards SaaS, somewhere on that scale, which I find is like this perfect equilibrium for us at the minute, is Airtable, which is, I think of it like the Airtable is to the back office and back end processes what Shopify is to the front end. It can be that like central hub for your core data sets. Where it's not great is like super high volume. Like we've got limits around row count. You can't go over 100K rows. So it's not looking to get on that customer order journey. But let's face it, SaaS has got order fulfillment, returns, customer support. That shit is tied up. I don't know if you swear on your podcast, Jason.
I not only do I swear, but I certainly encourage my guests to as well.
I just had a thought then. I was like, God, am I allowed to swear? So yeah, that's a spectrum I'm thinking about a lot. And everywhere along that journey, the other part with that is the user and making it easy for the user to use it and thinking who is the user of that piece of technology. And I apply that to almost every piece of technology that I look at now, even like merchandising on a website search. So something like on one end, you might have Shopify out the box search. Anyone can configure it, set up their filters, set up their collections, super, super easy. On the other end, you might have Algolia. We know Algolia is a really powerful search engine. It's got AI, it's got all this really great stuff in it. But the reality is if the user is in the middle of the spectrum and the possibilities are over here, they can't capture that. So you're far better off with an advanced commerce or a Tagalis landing it in the middle. So that, I think, yeah, that spectrum has been really useful to me. And I'm putting almost every software review I'm doing in that, trying to see where it lands on that spectrum. I don't know whether you've got something similar.
I do. And I think that just for clarity's sake, so you're looking at this through a lens of, okay, cool. If somebody, you know, is a D2C brand and they need to go selling online and they need an e-commerce platform, 9 times out of 10, a Shopify is going to do this 80-20 rule. It's going to do 80% of what they need. So therefore, sure, no problem recommending a Shopify if that's what's appropriate for that stage of that business and that type of business and the vertical that they're operating in, et cetera, then cool. You're quite happy to continue to recommend SaaS platforms where it's a good fit and where the brand can leverage at least 80% of the functionality of that platform as part of their daily operations. So in other words, you'd still recommend a PeopleVox in a scenario where, you know, you need a WMS and you can actually use a WMS and you're running your own warehouse and you have warehouse operations that you already need to automate. You don't need to build that piece of software from scratch because PeopleVox ticks 8 to 9 out of 10 boxes for most retail brands. Where you're talking about from a lens perspective and from a positioning perspective is, okay, I've got a specific operational function that I need to do in the back office of my business. I could go out and try to get a massive platform like a D365, or I could go and get, I could get NetSuite, or I could get Brightpearl. There's all these options out there from a back office perspective, but instead, maybe what I need is just Xero with maybe a little additional bespoke application sitting in the middle in Airtable that allows me to operationally run my business in a super efficient way. And I don't need to go buy NetSuite for now. And I can get away with Xero plus a custom app.
Whatever route you go down, you're going to end up with integrated low-code apps in your tech stack over the next 5 years. I wrote this to someone the other day. So this brand had implemented an ERP. They picked the wrong one. It happens all the time. I guess my definition of the wrong one was they put it in, they had to pull it out because the API fell over, couldn't handle the order volume through peak. Super common, right? But the mistake there wasn't necessarily the ERP, it was how it was implemented. Like you or I would have looked at the API guidelines and gone, hang on a minute, this rate limit's not going to cut it. This won't do. We can't possibly use this ERP for that, but is there a way that we could? And this was the bit I put. So yeah, number one, revisit order and inventory, but keep shipment and inventory level integration between 3PL and Shopify. So don't put the inventory order system on the critical path for orders. Like it's such a simple shift, but it totally de-risks. And if you've got all your 3PLs pre-integrated into Shopify, why risk the strength of that connection? And also every 3PL worth their salt has got a Shopify integration, but they're all going to find it pretty hard to integrate with NetSuite for orders and shipments and tracking details. It's extra complexity maybe you don't need. Yeah, so this is what I wrote. So option one, revisit an order and inventory management system, but keep the order to shipment and inventory level integration between 3PL and Shopify. So yep. Don't run it through the ERP and put it on that line, and then fill the gaps with integrated apps. And Airtable is what I'd recommend for using for that, and implement the finest software solutions you can for everything else. And then option two is fill the gaps between 3PL and your Shopify with integrated apps. So if you've been burnt by an ERP or inventory order system and you don't want to go back to one and you really want to bridge a gap, I think there's this idea of bridging a gap comes up a lot. You're 10 to 30 million, you haven't really got an IT team. You can't afford 2-3 people and a full-time NetSuite admin. I think a lot of brands are trying to bridge that gap of how can I get to the 100 million and then implement and do it at a scale where the business can actually absorb the hidden cost of doing it and deliver that project with a lot of confidence and put it in right first time. And then I guess, yeah, option three is just continue using Google Sheets and fingers crossed it all works out okay.
And I love the fact that you have just been banging on that drum of the dark stack. You've coined that term and you've integrated it into a lot of your messaging and a lot of your content. And I've got my own take on what the dark stack is, but maybe you can talk about the dark stack through in your context and through your lens and why the dark stack makes, I guess, solution architecture so bloody difficult these days when you and I go and we work with clients and we're doing discovery and we're trying to help them find a path forward. The dark stack is our arch nemesis.
It's our arch nemesis, but I think we're stronger for knowing it exists and acknowledging it. The old school way of putting in an ERP in a hub and spoke model, where you just throw NetSuite in and connect the best available WMS for NetSuite, the best available PIM for NetSuite, the best available PLM for NetSuite. We know that model doesn't stack up in terms of total cost of ownership, complexity, and also the core part of that value proposition from a NetSuite perspective was that NetSuite is a customizable ERP that you can build your own apps on top of. And the big shift we've had now is that because it's just so much cheaper and easier to build apps in low code, no code, and in particular with Airtable, why would you build all those custom workflows in an ERP platform that costs from $99 per user per month with all the additional costs of support and everything else, and only be supported and developed on top of by someone that's trained in NetSuite versus somebody being able to build out your custom workflows using writing some JavaScript scripts, building using a visual relational database, and then dragging and dropping interfaces for you, or even getting it to the point where your own IT team, your own people can actually amend and edit their own workflows, build their own software. Like the vision is on a whole nother level. And for me, that I think the dark stack for me was first of all about realizing it existed and I was the extent of the dark stack, and started to talk about it a lot more when I started that role at Supply Compass. Because before then, when I was doing warehouse systems, I used to think a lot about the system architecture when I put in PeopleVox with brands, because I realized that you needed to work out where all of your different data points were coming from. And PeopleVox didn't do things like purchase orders. So we'd have to work out where do you get purchase orders from. You had to work out where sales orders were coming from as well. So I had to figure out all of the little component pieces that fitted in around. And if I got to something that required the client to create a Google Sheet to make the process work for my piece of SaaS, I was delighted. I honestly thought, hallelujah, right, we fixed that. On to the next issue. Because I was just seeing the one Google Sheet that we were creating. And then really when I started consulting back in April, maybe should we talk a little bit about that, Jason, of the flip over to me going solo? I don't know whether you want to ask me anything in particular about it or whether I can just plow into it as I have been.
Look, I think let's finish off that previous thought just to a logical end before we jump into that next piece. And I think that to your point, the dark stack is any gap filler technology like Google Sheets or like Excel, where a business feels like those tools are so easy to use that it doesn't require a developer, and it can gap fill all of those little areas where a piece of SaaS software off the shelf, or even a piece of SaaS software off the shelf with some configuration or customization, can't quite get them there from either a collaboration perspective,
yeah,
or a scalability perspective, or a tech capability, internal tech capability and enablement perspective. I think to me, whilst Google Sheets is probably the most common component of a dark stack, or at least Excel or some sort of spreadsheeting platform, what I find, or it could be there's lots of spreadsheeting platforms out there, or it's that they need to use Asana for a piece of their workflow, or they need to use Jira for a piece of their workflow, or they need to use one of these other SaaS platforms and they corn it into doing things that it was never really designed to do. Because an off-the-shelf SaaS platform, even with ultimate configurability, can't quite get them there.
Yes. Yeah, that's an interesting way of thinking about it. So it's the ease of adoption that draws people into it. And I've alluded to this a bit with Slack, of how they've made it so easy for you to start using Slack and embed it across your business. But actually, yeah, no one really, my real issue with the dark stack when it's not being managed well is that you don't really know what goes on in there. And at the kind of center of it is siloed data, duplicate data. And that could be that me and you are tracking the launch of a product in two separate spreadsheets. We've got two separate project plans, if you like, when in reality, what we need is a total view of the product all the way through to launch. And then that data is in multiple places. It's being edited by one person at a time. So we're not actually collaborating on something. I know some of these tools like Asana fix this, but I really just see Asana as like another project management, like task management tool that sits on top of the actual work being done. And that's, I don't really feel like it gets to the core of the problem. I often see Asana in the tech stack of my clients, and it will be sitting there at £600-700 a month. And you'll say, who uses it? What are you using it for? And adoption's like pretty low, generally speaking, like marketing, creative operations teams, sometimes they're using it. But by and large, like it's just sitting there. And I think it's because it's creating another piece of work on top of it. So I guess as I'm saying that, I see Asana as trying to solve some of the dark stack problems by bringing all these siloed workflows together into one like reporting tool. But I actually just think it contributes to the problem because it's not actually fixing the underlying root cause of the issue, which is all the siloed data and things being done in multiple places across teams.
And I'm sure you see the exact same thing I do in relation to Google Sheets or Excel inside of Teams, which is that oftentimes when we go in and we start doing discovery, the CEO or the CTO or the CMO or whatever, I'll ask a question about a specific function in the business, and someone will pipe up, an SME, a subject matter expert in the business, will pipe up and they'll go, we do that in Google Sheets. And literally everyone at the table will look at that person and go, holy shit, I had no idea that you were doing that in Google Sheets. I had no idea. I literally had no idea that function was being done in Google Sheets. And they'll go, yeah, we've been doing that way for 3 years. And I bump into that so regularly, even for platforms that in theory have their own database and have their own functionality. Like it might be a PLM, it might be a product lifecycle management platform specifically for that, but it doesn't do this one thing that allows the team to collaborate to create a tech pack. And so there are certain things that they have to do in Google Sheets before that data can get into or out of the PLM. And that PLM, that's just one example. That is but one example. And we see that across many different pieces of the commerce stack where there's this one thing that this one piece of software just cannot do outside of Google Sheets and connecting to that Google Sheet via API or export and import. And that always scares me when even the business leadership is not quite aware just how much they're leveraging the dark stack just to survive day to day.
Yeah. And I think there's two huge opportunities, particularly for people who have already got an ERP and for merchants that are using Shopify. And for people that have got an ERP, I expected there to be less Google Sheets in businesses that had implemented something like NetSuite. And what I've found is that businesses that have an ERP use more Google Sheets than businesses that do not. And that to me was quite a big revelation when I came to it. And the amount of admin to serve the big ERP systems that demand data in certain structures and in certain ways means that getting the data in becomes a process of itself. And my view is that the data should just be an output of the correct workflow. And that's what we've been trying to get to the core of, particularly around product data. And then on the Shopify side, I think there's a few weaknesses in the Shopify platform once you start putting in expansion stores. And a lot of it is being papered over using Matrixify and a Google Sheet. And I think that space is already being addressed pretty aggressively. It's an obvious use case for Airtable. But I think that particular use case for Airtable is going to become massive in the next 12 to 18 months. There's some people building specific extensions inside the Airtable platform, which will enable you in one click to open a base and sync all of your major Shopify data types between the two platforms and then manage a bi-directional sync using Shopify's GraphQL, like out the box, five clicks, and you're up and running. So all the issues people have with the admin panel of I can't shift data around, or I can't change pricing easy, or I can't do bulk edits, all those things are going to be fixed by tools that cost a couple of $100 a month.
And the beauty of that also is that you then have version control, you then have audit trail, you then have granular user management, you have all the typical stuff that Shopify doesn't, it's not meant to be a PIM, it's not meant to be a PLM, it's meant to be an e-commerce platform. And so short of going with a heavyweight PIM or PLM like a Riversand or B product or like any of those other platforms that are out there, short of doing that, this kind of bespoke, semi-bespoke middleware platform, for lack of a better term, it's not just the middleware platform because it doesn't just provide connectivity because it's got its own database, but you can think of it almost like a lightweight PIM, or you can think of it almost like a lightweight PLM that's so user-friendly for the organization that naturally leads to ultra high adoption rate, which automatically limits the proliferation of the dark stack.
Exactly. So with Airtable, we're removing Google Sheets and optimizing workflow and cleaning data, which is exactly what you would have expected an ERP to do. But it's to deliver that on Airtable is a fraction of the cost of implementing an ERP. So I think the business case for Airtable is going to become more and more to do it before you do the ERP, to get your data workflows and your data structure organized, to make all of your decisions around data, and then it will make that move to a more structured ERP much, much easier for brands.
Couldn't agree more. Now, if we go back to that conversation that we were going to have just before around how did you even get here and how did you kick off your foray into consulting? What was the prompt for that? And more importantly, you've already pivoted a couple of times since you first started consulting. And we've had lots of cool conversations about this and how you go to market and how you sell your own services and how you sell yourself and how you do content and all those things. But even just from a core services perspective, a core offering perspective, a core value prop perspective, you've already pivoted a couple of times. But how did you even decide finally to pull the trigger on doing your own thing?
I think I ended up in a place where it felt like the only option. And it just seemed so obvious. I'd had a bit of a fear around doing my own thing. I think I maybe misconstrued my father's business to some degree. He's run his own business since I've been alive. He founded it the year that I was born. And for a long time, he's always kept it very small. It's been him and then him plus my mum and then now just him. And I mistook that for a weakness. I thought, why haven't you built it into something bigger? And I still thought that for the early part of my career. I was in a business where we just focused on growing and scaling and all that good stuff. And then the culture of the one-person business is suddenly in vogue. And I realized that actually my dad was a bit of a trailblazer in his mindset. And he talks about the freedom it's given him and the opportunity and the flexibility. And maybe I'd focused a lot on what it can mean if you run your own business. And if you're not careful, your own business will run you. And the one thing I promised myself getting into this was that I wouldn't let my business run me and give in to the busyness. And I think, so far, I think I've done a pretty good job of that. So how did I end up? So ended up trying to make a SaaS product at Supply Compass work. Realized that most of the things that I was leveraging to try and grow Supply Compass were things that I could do for any product. And my initial instinct pre-Supply Compass had been to go and consult with other SaaS products on go-to-market. And what I found with SaaS products and go-to-market is that SaaS companies have loads of smart people, loads of uber smart people. They've got plenty of cash to throw at people and they attract lots of really nerdy people like me. So I'm one of many in the world of SaaS. And I actually found it really hard to find SaaS companies that wanted my help, frankly, on go-to-market. And I knew I could do it and be of help, but the demand just wasn't there. So I took the hint with that. And then after I'd spent a year with Supply Compass, like figuring out how to sell PLM, having not known anything about it at the start, by the time I got to the end of it, I was like, I don't just understand PLM. What it showed me was how quickly I could go deep on a particular operational function in an e-commerce business. And then coming towards the end of that year, I mapped out in Miro. I've shared this around quite a bit. I've not actually shared the Miro board, but I'll do that at some point. I'm a bit embarrassed of how many gaps there are now compared to how I see everything. But I basically mapped in Miro from product design, development, inventory planning, merchandising, production, supply chain logistics, through to goods inbound, warehousing, fulfillment, returns, exchanges, customer support. That whole workflow, I mapped in every document that I'd seen, every feature that I could think of. And I started mapping against all of it, all of the different solution vendors. And just as Supply Compass was coming to a very abrupt end, I was fortunate enough to show that Miro board to a couple of brands that I had good relationships with. Unfortunately, a couple of them just turned around to me and said, whatever that thing is, can you come and do it for us? And I don't think really they or I knew exactly what I was coming in to do. And I think the last 12 months has been a process of me getting a little bit closer to me knowing exactly what it is I do, and the brands I'm working with getting closer to knowing exactly what it is I do. I hope every brand that I've worked with feels like they're better off for working with me. But like anyone who's really a year into turning pro in their craft, I'm still learning a hell of a lot with every like project and engagement that I do. It's endless what you can learn doing this. But yeah, I'm just glad I got started when I did, and I had the right people around me pushing me and cheering me on. I think it's really nice to see when you go and do something like that, who goes and gets in your corner. And I've written about this a lot. There were certain people in the ecosystem who, like, without question, I just felt like they were there on my side, part of my business, literally from day one. And that those kind of people and that network coming through makes a huge difference to you.
Could not agree more. I didn't realize this is one thing that's why I love this, doing this podcast, is because I didn't realize that you had almost exactly the same upbringing as me with family business. I had no idea. And my upbringing was almost identical. My dad had his own business from the time, since about a year or two before I was born, He was servicing typewriters back in the day, and then ultimately ended up servicing computers and selling computers as well through his own retail computer store. And it was a one-man band business. He only ever had the maximum number of employees he ever had was one, plus my mother. And my mother was in charge of the books and the sending out of invoices and talking to customers. And my dad was in charge of actually doing the services and providing the service to the customers. And so I guess I was a little bit similar to you in that that's all I ever knew was a small business, a small family business. And then when I got out there, I guess, into the workforce and I started getting deeper into my career, I guess I had a similar epiphany to you that, look, I love helping to build big businesses. I love helping to build big brands. I love helping them scale from nothing to $100 million. That's super exciting and it's a massive rush. But I also came to a realization in my 40s that I now need to be able to monetize my experience, my knowledge, and my capability in a way that allows me to live a lifestyle I want to live in tandem with that. I don't want to have to sacrifice my lifestyle to do something that I love. And through being a solopreneur like you, I've been able to achieve that. And now I'm able to be free and I can work from anywhere in the world with a laptop and an internet connection. And I happen to now be in Mexico, where I was a month and a bit ago, I was in New Zealand still. And so I think we've gone down a little bit of a similar path. We took a little bit of a circuitous route to get there that was unique to us, but I think we've ultimately landed in a very similar place, which is we don't even know necessarily exactly how we do what we do until we get in there, and we do adapt a little bit chameleon-like on the fly when we need to meet a specific client's needs, all the while learning along the way and putting and stacking our toolkit and putting extra tools in our toolkit along the way so that we can be better with every single engagement. We get that 1% better with every single engagement because of the experience of the engagement before it. And I'm super proud of you. I've been a person that's been in your corner since day one and urging you to go out on your own because of your unique experiences and your ability to see things and see around corners that other people don't see. It's those insights from that, the time at the wheel really is really super hard to replace. And I think the businesses that work with both of us are lucky. I think they're lucky, not so much because we're the best in the world at what we do, because I think that's all subjective, but I think that we bring a very unique perspective to their business that for me is primarily about helping them de-risk their business. That to me, it's about helping them see things that they would never see to minimize surprises. Mm-hmm. One of the things that I've seen throughout my entire career is that there are always surprises, particularly in large scale project work. There's always surprises. No matter how much you try to minimize those surprises internally, they always happen. And so by working with people that have seen hundreds of different variations of surprises along the way, they can help minimize the shock and surprise that happens inevitably as you're going through any large scale deployment of technology.
Yeah. And I think, yeah, it's the old saying, nobody, Jonathan, the founder of PeopleVox, used to say, nobody likes surprises.
It's hard for businesses to plan for surprises. Let's put it that way.
It is really hard to plan for surprises. And I think I guess it's just making people more aware of the upside and downside of things. One of the bits I've really tried to do in terms of, I haven't got like a grand vision for what I'm doing with the business, but there's certainly a desire to straddle both worlds. Like, I don't want to be like totally looking at things from the perspective of the brands that I'm working for. And I don't want to take the perspective 100% of the vendors that I'm partnering with to match to brands, because I can see a real strength in me sitting between the two. Because yeah, if I'm across 10, 15 brands at any one time, ranging from a million to 100, and I'm working with a brand that are doing 120 million at the minute with 200 retail stores. And the brands are so different along that range. But you know that if you work closely with the right partners for a long enough time, you're going to get to a point where you can service all of those clients with the right solution. And it may well be, and I guess this is my experience from being a vendor, I used to dream of having clients that would sit down with us and give us all of the requirements and the things they'd love to see in the roadmap and what we should be developing next. Like, when you're working for a SaaS vendor, I really think of it as endless market research, isn't it? And my time at Supply Compass felt like market research. Like, the product wasn't fully there yet. We were learning as we went. Clients were buying into it on like the faith of where the product would go and what it could do for them in the future. And that's where I realized that actually some of those brands would have just been better off paying us for our time to service them. And then we could have been building the software as another thing that we did. And actually, I've advised a few startup founders who have got like deep, like expertise in one particular area. I was speaking to a guy who was building like a wholesale platform, and he's got vast wholesale go-to-market experience in B2B fashion. And I was like, dude, you need to just be selling your time. And as you sell your time, you're making the transaction really clear and apparent with the brands that you're working with, that you're selling them your time and you're delivering value to them. You're helping them and advising them. And at the same time, you're going to get that market research. And I think for my own like longer term perspective, I am viewing a portion of the work that I'm doing as that market research piece. But at the moment, what I'm using my insight to do is feed back to software vendors and help them inform their roadmaps and shape their products to where I think they need to be going. And that's where it's like magic, right? You know, I'm sure you've had it, Jason, where you spot a feature or you spot a feature set and then you see it 3-4 times. And then you speak to the founder of a SaaS business and you're like, you need to build this. Trust me, you need to build this. And when you're on the SaaS vendor side, that is absolute gold dust to really have someone who knows the customer feeding back information like that.
That's the dream. If you're a SaaS vendor, that is literally the dream, is that you're not only getting feedback from end consumers of the technology, but you're getting feedback from the channel. Because the channel feedback, because you'll never be able to see everything, just won't. Even dealing with end customers, you will not be able to see everything. You will not be able to see all the use cases. You will not be able to see all the challenges. You will not be able to see all the custom integrations. You will not see all the workarounds that have been put into place in the market around your technology without having a very close relationship with your partners. There's no way you can see all of that, because not only will your customers, but also the partners helping them implement that technology will be doing the weirdest shit with your technology that you can ever possibly imagine. They will be using it in ways that you cannot fathom, and they will be creating workarounds that you cannot fathom. And you just won't know that they exist. You literally will not know that they exist, because maybe it's integrated with your platform via API, or maybe it's integrated with your platform via CSV. Whatever shit that is going on outside your platform to deal with the deficiencies of your platform is invisible to you. And that's why feedback from the channel is as important, if not more important, than your end users.
Yeah. So quite, and you're synthesizing that information for them. You've seen it in 4 or 5 places. So I'm finding now I'm not going to my partners with the problem. I'm able to go with, I've had a real think about this, and in your solution, if you could just add this, that would be great. And some of them are like, oh, we thought about doing that, but we hadn't quite cemented that. Is that, do you think there's a need for that? Hell yeah. It's coming up all the time. I run 10 to 15 workshops a week. I've got every single issue that's come up in the past 12 months in a giant Airtable. If I type in the word bundles in Shopify, I can tell you that the new Shopify bundles API is going to fucking change things for people. That's a real problem they're solving. So
or location management inside Shopify as part of POS, for example. Like, that's been a problem for years, literally years, that makes Shopify POS non-viable for a chain over 2 to 3 stores. And now that you can control the where order routing goes based on certain conditions, now that all of a sudden becomes more viable for a significantly larger market of merchants.
They just need to sort the transfer order request now can be raised inside Shopify, but the bit that's missing is taking that transfer order, turning it into a PO on Stocky, the Shopify app they acquired for purchasing.
Yep.
And then enabling receipt of goods in using a barcode scanner and then stock take in the store. That specific workflow there, I've seen that 6 times in the last 12 weeks where people are just pulling their hair out going, how do we deal with this? What's the solution? And then, those sorts of things need to be solved in platform. It's just not attractive for someone to go in and fix that, I think, when those bits are so small. Shopify are listening. They are developing a lot. I'd say the one thing I do respect a lot about them is they still keep pushing updates. And there's a lot of SaaS vendors in the market that have been around as long as them that can't push an update without breaking absolutely everything.
Yeah. I think we're both seeing that. I think it's so incredibly common that these SaaS platforms, they've got a lot of great ideas, but you've got to have 2 components here that I think as a SaaS platform will make you robust and scalable and actually have a long lifespan as a technology. I think you've got to have fantastic product people, but more importantly, I think you've got to have incredible DevOps. I think that DevOps rigor is so mission critical, to the point where a lot of people think about technical debt in their own businesses and across the plethora of platforms that they run. But these SaaS vendors have to deal with technical debt too. That's what a lot of people don't think about. When you deprecate an API and go from V1 to V2, for example, all the things that used to work with V1, if you don't have some sort of migration pathway to V2, you're going to break a whole lot of customer shit and a whole lot of middleware shit. And that's going to piss a lot of people off. And sometimes that's hard to do. And in fact, sometimes some of these SaaS platforms even themselves have to make a hard fork. And that's not nice, but sometimes it's required. And sometimes you have to have a V1 of your platform full stop. And then sometimes you've got to have a V2 of your platform full stop. And that is something that's really not well understood by customers of these SaaS platforms. They think that SaaS is a silver bullet.
Very few have managed like a transition. Like, we used to compete a lot with Ship Hero when I was at PeopleVox. And it was great to sell against it. There was a point where they completely rewrote a huge part of their platform. Like, they must have completely redid the whole thing, which would have been an absolute nightmare, but kudos to them because they pulled it off and then flipped into a 3PL and raised 100 million. If you can make those transitions as a SaaS platform, like, fair play, but it's incredibly hard to completely reinvent. And for the founders to have the vision and the longevity to reinvent and go again, because it really does feel like a go again when you do that. And that's also why, yeah, I think some of the original, like, Shopify ecosystem vendors are now starting to age a little bit, right? Yeah, if you look at the category of reviews, for example, like, I think a lot of the new entrants in the reviews category, like your reviews.io and Akendo and Junip and whatever, there's loads of reviews platforms in that space where feature-wise, they're comparable, if not better than the established. It's just they don't have the brand name and the brand affinity and the kudos that comes with it. And that's actually where I'm finding I'm curating a lot of that stuff for my clients, where the e-com manager doesn't really look into reviews very much. They might go on Google, they might go on the App Store, ask a friend, or look at a big brand that they know. But to actually know, like, what the up and coming thing is, because often, like, the up and coming is where the future's going with these different bits of technology. And if you catch them at the right time, you get that nice mix of the founders still running it, the roadmap's absolutely pumping, a lot of the cool brands are jumping onto it because they're doing something innovative, and it's pretty cost effective. Like, they've got to that point where they're on the ascendancy and they're not maximizing the revenue from you. I'd contrast that to something like where Klaviyo is right now, where it's assumed that position of total dominance in the email marketing space, and it is consistently the most expensive tool in my client's tech stack. If they haven't got an ERP or a WMS, Klaviyo is the most expensive thing. Take Shopify out the equation. If they're using Shopify, that's doing a hell of a lot for them. Some loyalty is another one. I don't know what your views on loyalty are, Jason, but it seems pretty weighty in cost in the tech stack quite often compared to other apps that are doing far more important things.
Yeah, and I think you hit the nail on the head. There's been an ascendancy of legacy apps that have, you know, and Yotpo's probably a prime example of that, where they've acquired other technologies along the way, rebranded it, tried to integrate it into their platform to expand their functionality instead of building it in-house, meeting with some level of success, some in some cases better than others, and then being able to jack up their prices as they achieve more and more market dominance. They just continue to jack up their prices and put the screws to existing clients through rising SaaS costs. And we're just seeing that across almost every single vertical of software. But the beautiful thing, like you say, is now it's easier than ever before to create a competing product. But it's about how do they go to market effectively with that without having to have necessarily VC investment to do it. And I think that's the barrier. That's the moat that these big players like the Klaviyos of the world and like the Yotpos of the world have created. They've created massive moats in terms of the cost to go to market against them is astronomical.
Yeah. Yeah, and that's where we can cut through that, because we can truly see them what they are. I think the saying, like, experts buy features,
yes,
is true. And that's one of the things that I try to focus on, of like actually feature comparing stuff, which is ironic because as a vendor, I used to absolutely feel sick to the teeth when I received an RFP. But by and large, I'd get one and they didn't understand the features. They were just guessing at what the features may be. So I'd still consider my repulsion to RFPs to be valid. But yeah, definitely thinking about what are the feature set and what's the value for money. I think someone said to me the other day, there's almost an inverse relationship between the cost of software and the value for money.
Yeah. So
the likelihood, the more it costs, the less value you're actually going to retain, you're likely to receive of that, and the less likely you are to get the ROI. Whereas human bias is that we think that by spending the most and having the most in a piece of software, we're avoiding that, like, regret feeling that you get where you don't buy the top of the range, and then we fear living in regret that we missed out on that feature. I don't know what the bias is, but it's someone listening to this is going to be like, bias, but I can't think of what it is.
Confirmation bias.
Is it confirmation? Yeah, they just, at the end of it, they're just regretting, thinking, oh, and then in the end, they go for the thing that was too big, and then they bought too many features and they spent more and they feel better about it. But actually, the regret that you're more likely to feel is, oh my God, this thing's a pain in the ass to implement. Oh my God, they're charging us more for that. Oh, the fees have gone off 20%. Oh, why is it taking so long to implement? Oh, this is really difficult to configure. Oh, the e-commerce.
Oh, I need a team. I need 5 people to run this piece of kit.
Why didn't the e-commerce team don't like it? Why didn't we see it before you bought it? Oh, we did a couple of demos, but you weren't allowed to try it before we bought it. Oh, okay.
Oh, I love this. I love this. I love this stroll down memory lane. I love how you've got to where you are. I think that this experience that you've shared is super valuable. I know it's valuable to me. I'm sure it'll be valuable to the audience. I've had a killer chat with you. An hour has flown by. It feels like 2 minutes. And I always enjoy chatting with you, Mr. Ollie Rhodes. It's a joy. It's a pleasure. We have taken very similar paths across our career. And we have a deep feeling of, I guess, obligation to our industry. We have a deep sense of affinity and appreciation and love for our industry and a deep sense of wanting to give back. Sure, we got to make a living just like anybody else. But at the end of the day, if we weren't able to give back, then I don't think either of us would feel as fulfilled mm-hmm. as we do doing what we're doing. And I love the sense of saying one thing in a discovery and somebody's eyes light up at the table and go, I didn't even know we could do that. I didn't even know that was possible. I didn't even know that technology existed, or I didn't know that by tweaking one thing in our process, we could make our business 10% more efficient. I didn't even know that was a possibility. And so I guess it's for us, the fulfillment comes from knowing the possibilities that can be shared based on a whole lot of painful experiences along our journey that hopefully we're preventing our clients from making those or needing to have those same painful experiences to get to the place where we are. And that is super fulfilling. That feels awesome. And at the end of a project, even if it's a long, drawn out, painful project, because projects that they always go through that trough of despair, I find that almost all projects, no matter how short or long they are, there's a trough of despair right in the middle where even the client can sometimes lose sight of the end vision, of the end goal, and of where we set out to get to when we sat down and had our first discussion. It's up to us in many instances to keep the faith, fly the flag, and get them over the finish line and help to keep them motivated and positive along the way. And we're more coaches, I think, than anything else is really what it comes down to. And yeah, I've super enjoyed learning from your journey along the way. And I just super appreciate your transparency, your raw honesty. And I'm super loving your current content, I guess, trend of making lots of daily raw videos. I'm really loving that. And I'm getting a lot out of it. Look, I've been in the industry for over 20 years and I'm getting a truckload out of your content. So I can only imagine how valuable your content is to people that have been doing this only 2, 3, 4, 5, 10 years. I'm sure they're learning a shitload from your content. So thank you for being who you are and what you do for our industry, man.
Dude, yeah, that's really great encouragement. I really appreciate that. I was just thinking then it's like when you said about the pain, I think it's like that many things worth doing are really hard and painful. And it's almost more Zen master style. You need to frame the pain in the right way. And know the pain's coming and it's going to be worth it, because whatever you choose to do in business, it's going to be difficult if it's worth doing. And often it's being able to pull off the harder projects. I think that's where I don't know if I'm quite going to be able to take my advisory to the levels of some of the projects I've seen you pull off, but being able to convince people that those things that really are painful can end up being a massive strength if they can push through with it, rather than just avoiding and trying to do the easy shit all the time, because that's doesn't necessarily take you anywhere, does it? Just round in circles.
Now, doing hard stuff, I had an old boss tell me the higher the hurdle, the higher the barrier that you're trying to get across, the greater the sense of accomplishment when you do. And his other famous saying was, you just got to lean into it, buddy. There's no easy way around this. You just have to lean into the pain. And the sooner you lean into the pain, the sooner you'll get past the pain, and the sooner you'll get past the hurdle, and the sooner you'll feel that super sense of achievement. And that stuck with me ever since, is just lean into it. And yeah, it's sometimes really hard to do. And especially I find that when you're at about the 75% mark of a project, clients get weary and they're starting to get close to the UAT phase, which is always very intimidating for clients because they know they're going to have to do a tremendous amount of testing and it's going to take them out of BAU and they're going to have to devote a lot of time and energy to this, give lots of feedback, and you can't do it for them. They have to do it. And the subject matter experts in the business have to do it. But I'm rambling at this stage. But thank you for your time. Super appreciate it. Awesome episode number 200. Hope did this episode primarily for me in a selfish way, because I wanted to talk to you. I've wanted to talk to you for a while now as a second catch up around where you're at, where you've landed with your own gig. And I'm super glad we made time to make this happen. We're going to have to do it again soon. Let's maybe not wait to episode 300 to feature Mr. Oliver Rhodes again.
Let's not do episode 300 because we tried to squeeze it in earlier. If it happens at 300, I'll be happy. I'm pleased to see you finally made your move to Mexico, and I'm glad we've got better time zone map over now as well.
Absolutely. Absolutely. That brutal New Zealand to UK opposite ends of the day thing was a whole 12-hour thing was brutal. Thanks, man. Let's catch up again soon. I love your work. I want to see you keep doing what you're doing, because you're doing good stuff, man.
Sweet, dude. Take it easy.
Are you a B2B or D2C e-commerce merchant? then head over to greenwoodconsulting.net to learn how we can help you scale your business.